The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My friend Susan just texted me, "Break a lip." Vaginal humor, y'all. I am so happy to be here because there's air conditioning, okay? I was in Baltimore last night and there was no air conditioning. And I'm like, I am a Jewish woman and this is offensive to me. This is an affront to my faith. And I took my Spanx off because I was pissed. Which was really unfortunate because, like, thanks to the beauty of social media, I got to see every photograph that I took that night, and my bra straps are in all of them. And then you get the email from your agent, who has also seen all of the pictures, and Jen, you might want to consider some undergarments. And it's like, I was wearing undergarments. Like, that was the whole point. So anyhow, I was watching The Bachelor with my daughters the other night. And my six-year-old says to me, I go to the kitchen to, like, get a snack, and I come back, and she says, "Mommy, what is a whore?" I'm like, fuck, I know they shouldn't be watching this. And I'm like, all right. I said, "Phoebe, do you remember when I explained to you how babies are made?" And she sort of looks horrified, but she says, "Yes, I remember that." And I said, "Okay, so, you know, the man gives the lady the special seed. Well, there are ladies who will do the thing with the special seed, only not because they want a baby or because they are in love, but they will do it for money. And it's a very, very sad thing because your body is so special and the thing that you do to have a..." And she's looking at me with this look of terror on her face. And finally her big sister says, "Mom," she asked, "what a poor was." And I'm like, oh yeah, that shit's different. Forget what I just said. Like, never think of that again. Ever, ever, ever. Don't think of it. But then the oldest one, okay, she's 11, and, like, her body is going through the magical changes that the body goes through. So I am always trying to talk to her about this, and she does not want to talk about it, okay? So I'm like, "Lucy," you know, she'll come home from school, she'll be like, "Mom, we need to talk." And I'll be like, "Is it about your changing body?" She's like, "No." And I'm like, "Well, we need to talk about your changing body." And she's like, "I want to talk about my play dates." And I'm like, "No, your changing body." So I buy her the American Girl doll book because in addition to making overpriced toys, they make, like, this great book that's called The Care and Feeding of You, which is the book that, like, everybody recommends for puberty. And it talks about your body and your feelings and your skin and sort of puts everything in this great holistic context. And I give it to Lucy, who does not care about the great holistic context, because I give her the book and I say, "Why don't you read this and you and I can talk." I leave her room, and then I hear this whoosh, thunk, as she throws it out of her bedroom and into the hall. What? What are you doing to me? So I give it back to her, and then it's in the trash can. I fish it out of the trash can and give it to her again, and then it's in the koi pond. Like, she just does not want to go there. So I'm like, all right, we're going to have to do the end run around puberty. And I schedule her 11-year-old well child checkup. And I explain to her pediatrician, I'm like, we gotta talk to her, but she doesn't want to talk. And he's like, "Don't you worry." So we, you know, she's on the table and he's like checking out her eyes and he's checking out her ears. And he says, "So Lucy, has your mom talked to you about some of the changes your body's going through?" And she's like, "Uh-huh, lying." And he's like, "So you understand about puberty?" And she's like, "Oh yeah, lying." And he says, "Because the reason this is very important is that no one wants you to be surprised, because, like, there are going to be things that happen that if you didn't know they were going to happen would be very upsetting. For instance, if you were to just start bleeding from your vagina..." Okay, y'all, Lucy had no idea that that was going to happen. I think that she thought that the booby fairy was going to, like, stop off under her pillow and, like, leave her some breasts and some hair. And so, like, we get out of there, and she's like, and I'm like, "You told me you knew what menstruation was." And she's like, "I thought I did." And I'm like, so are we going to talk about this? No. And I go, okay. You know, I understand now that there are gift boxes that you can send your kid that have, you know, the pads and the, like, you know, the golf pencil sized tampons and, you know, the whose vagina is this for tampons. And like, I'm gonna get her the box, and I'm just gonna really hope. Like, I don't know what to do, you guys. Like, I'm trying to, like, be like the cool mom, you know, like the, hey, we can discuss this, and she does not want to discuss it. So I'm a little lost. I'll let you guys know. I'm gonna read to you a short bit from All Fall Down, which I'm going to display proudly. And then I'm gonna tell you a little bit about why I wrote this book. And then we're going to take questions, which is the best part of everything. And I hope you guys all got cannoli. Did you guys see? Okay, right? The mothership cannoli. I'm like, it's like the alien cannoli. It's like full of little baby cannoli, and it's going to like burst. Vaginal. All right, here we go. Here we go. Do you generally use alcohol or drugs more than once a week? I hesitated with my hand over the page. I'd picked up the magazine to read the How to Dress for Your Shape story advertised on the cover, but it had flopped open to a quiz that asked, has your drinking or drug use become a problem? And something had made me stop. Maybe it was the black and white photograph of a woman in profile bending sadly over her wine glass, or maybe the statistic beside it that said that prescription painkiller overdose was now the leading cause of accidental death of women in America, surpassing even car crashes. I had a pen in my hand. I'd been using it to fill out the stack of forms for Eloise's five-year-old well-child checkup, and almost without thinking, I made an X in the box for yes. I crossed my legs and looked around Dr. McCarthy's waiting room, suddenly worried that someone had seen what I'd written. Of course, no one was paying any attention. Sleet ticked at the panes of the oversized windows, a radiator clunked in the corner. The lamplit room on the third floor of an office building at the corner of 9th and Chestnut, with a volunteer in a striped pinny at a knee-high table reading Amelia Bedelia to kids in miniature chairs, felt cozy, a respite from the miserable winter weather. We'd parked in the lot on 9th Street and trekked through the February slush to get here on time, Ellie stepping delicately over the piles of crusted snow and the ankle-deep icy puddles at the corners, complaining that her feet were getting wet and her socks were getting squishy. I'd lured her on with the promise of a treat at Federal Donuts when her checkup was over. You guys sensing a theme here with the... Federal Donuts tweeted at me today, and I think I was, like, more excited than, like, when my husband proposed. I was just... They're like, thank you for, you know, name dropping us in your book. And I'm like, thank you for making the best fried chicken. And I'm like, this is sad. This is like, they're not giving me anything for free. Like, calm down. Okay. Ellie tugged at my sleeve. How much longer? Honey, I really can't say. The doctors need to take care of the sick kids first, and you, Miss Lucky, are not sick. She stuck out her lower lip in a cartoonish pout. It isn't fair. We made an appointment. True, but remember when you had that bad sore throat? Dr. McCarthy saw you right away, even before the kids who had appointments. Ellie smoothed her skirt and wandered off toward the toy basket. I recrossed my legs and checked out the crowd. The room was predictably full. There were the first-time mothers from Queen Village and Society Hill who wore their babies wrapped in yards of organic cotton, hand-dyed and woven by indigenous Peruvian craftswomen who were paid a living wage. The moms from the Section 8 housing pushed secondhand strollers and fed their infants from plastic bottles, as opposed to ostentatiously breastfeeding, or slipping the baby a few ounces of organic formula in a BPA-free bottle with a silicone-free nipple hidden under a prettily patterned, adorably named nursing cover-up. I'd worn one called the Hooter Hider. True. On days when you use drugs and alcohol, do you usually have 3 drinks/doses or more? Well, define dose. 1 Percocet from the bottle I got after I had my wisdom teeth pulled? 2 Vicodin described for a herniated disc I'd suffered in step class at the gym? Could 3 pills count as a dose? I didn't answer. Do you use drugs or alcohol to, quote, unwind or, quote, relax? Well, hello, that's what they're there for. And what was so bad, really? How many times had I heard my husband say, I need to go for a run, or my best friend Janet say, I need a glass of wine? What I did was no different. It was actually better. A run was time-consuming and sweaty and hard on the joints, and wine could stain. Do you sometimes take more than the amount prescribed? Yes. Not always, but sometimes. I'd take one pill, and then 10 or 15 or 20 minutes later, if I wasn't feeling the lift, the slow unwinding of the tight muscles around my neck and shoulders I'd expected, I'd take another. Have you gotten intoxicated on drugs and alcohol more than 2 times in the past year? Well, that was tricky. With painkillers, you did not slur or get sloppy. Your child would not come home from school to find mommy passed out in a puddle of her own vomit or anyone else's. Hang on, I gotta flip a little bit here. I'm skipping the backstory. Have you ever felt like you should cut down on your drinking or drug use? Feeling suddenly queasy, I lifted my head and looked around the waiting room to see again if anyone had noticed that I was taking this quiz really seriously. Did I think about cutting down? Sure, sometimes. More and more often, I had the nagging feeling that things were getting out of control, and then I'd think, oh, please. I had prescriptions for everything I took, and if Dr. A didn't know what Dr. B was giving me, well, that wasn't necessarily a problem, and if it was, pharmacies would be set up to flag it, right? The pills helped me manage everything I needed to manage. Have other people criticized your drinking or drug use or been annoyed by it? I checked no fast and emphatically, trying not to think about how nobody criticized my use because nobody knew anything about it. Have you ever planned not to use that day but done it anyway? Yes. I had thought about stopping. I'd tried a few times and managed for a few days, but during the last few not-today days, it was as if my brain and my body had disconnected at some critical juncture. I'd be standing in my closet in my T-shirt or the workout clothes I'd put on in hopes that wearing them would make me more inclined to actually exercise, thinking no, and watching my body from the outside, watching my hand uncap the bottle, watching my fingers select a pill. So, dun dun dun. That's how we start. And I wanted to tell you a little bit because I, you know, obviously the question that you get all the time is like, you know, why this book, why this topic? When I was 38, I was in a really successful, happy place. I'd written a bunch of books. The books had done well. I was married. I had Lucy, my oldest daughter. I'd just given birth to Phoebe. I had a development deal with ABC. I was in Los Angeles trying to sell them a TV show, and I woke up at 5 in the morning, which is like 8 in the morning our time, don't be impressed, and I was nursing Phoebe and holding her in one arm and checking my phone with the other hand because multitasking, and I saw 7 missed calls from a 203 area code, and 203 is Connecticut. And so I look at the number, and I don't recognize it. My mom lives in Connecticut, and thinking something's going on there. So I do the reverse lookup, and the number is for the Rockville Police Department. And I'm like, I haven't been in Rockville, Connecticut, and I don't think I've done anything wrong, so what's going on here? So I call the number, and I learn that my father had died. And my father left my mom when I was 15, and he decided he didn't want to be a husband anymore. And there was a lot of that going around in the 80s. That happened. But he also decided he didn't want to be a father anymore. So there were 4 of us, and he sort of sat us down and said, you know, I'm really not going to be around a lot. Think of me as like a fun uncle. And we were all sort of like, no, that's weird. So for the next like 20-something years, he was in and out of my life. I would see him, then I wouldn't see him, and he would be in touch, and then he would not be in touch. And he'd gotten remarried, and then he'd gotten a woman pregnant, married her, and divorced her before the baby was born. So like I knew his life was chaotic. I had no idea how awful it was until I got this call. And the only way I can describe it is sort of like this domino game of awful, where it gets bad, and then it gets worse, and then it gets worse. And then when you think it can get no worse, it gets worse some more. So I flew back to Connecticut with the baby and with my sister and my brothers. My father had died in a Section 8 apartment. He was living with a girlfriend, and we sat down with the girlfriend, and the girlfriend is trying to give us some like obviously cockamamie story about your father had diabetes and he wasn't managing it well and he was trying to treat himself and I think maybe he had a heart attack. And my sister, who is like a cut the BS lady, is just like, what was really going on here? And I'm waiting to hear alcohol. Because, you know, he would have a drink and people drink, and I knew about that. And she said, well, you know, for many years, your father struggled with, and I'm waiting to hear alcohol. And she says, heroin and crack cocaine. I was not expecting to hear heroin and crack cocaine. I mean, because my dad was a psychiatrist, not a jazz musician. It just, It was mind-blowing. It was just the last thing that I ever thought I would hear. And then we're going through his stuff, which was it was so sad and awful because it was like big box of my books, and then more porn. And I just did not know how to process that. It was like, it was terrible. And the porn was really disturbing. So like, I just want to say if there's any, like, we all have things on our browsers. I understand that. Just like delete them. Set your computer up to like, after you die, just like eat that stuff or something. Because like someone's going to have to see it, okay? And someone is going to, if you leave perhaps Polaroids behind, someone is going to find those and never be able to unsee those things again. Dad. Oh. You know, so it's like porn, my books, more porn, box of letters from the state of Connecticut Department of Youth and Family Services regarding unpaid child support. And I'm like, oh, this is probably to do with the four of us, because for years my mother had been taking him to court because he never, ever, ever paid her child support. And I open these letters, and they're saying, in regard to the minor child, David H., and my dad had a child who was three when he died. So I have a half-brother who's nine now. And it was fucked up. It was awful. It was sad. It was brutal. And I'm thinking, like, okay, on the one hand, like, I'm, you know, a couple of years went by, and I'm sort of trying to live with this, like, new normal. And I'm, on the one hand, like, things look great. Like, you know, the books are doing well, and, like, that's all going well. But on the other hand, you know, I'd had a television show that sort of went down spectacularly in flames. And let me just give you all a piece of advice. If you want to do a show about a big girl who takes on the world and wants to change the world and not let the world change her, do not let the network insist that you cast the star who has just lost 30 pounds, has no interest in ever playing that girl again, and won't wear padding. Okay, that's not going to work for you. You know, and my marriage had ended. And as the child of divorced parents, that was just like the last thing that I ever wanted. So I'm sitting there with, like, you know, my busted marriage and, you know, my Wikipedia page that is always going to say short-lived television show. And I'm thinking, like, okay, like, where do we go from here? Like, what do I want to do? How do I want to feel about what I'm doing? What do I want to show my daughters about resiliency and disappointment and how you handle it? What do I want them to know about privilege and responsibility, and how, if you're lucky enough to have a voice and a platform, what do you do with those things? So part of my deal was the New York Times. New York Times has a readership that's 50-50 men, women, does not touch books like mine, does not touch quote-unquote chick lit or romance or any of the genre fiction that women read. And why is this? Why is it that with a 50-50 male-female readership, their critics review 65% books by men, 35% books by women? Whose stories aren't getting told here? And I started asking those questions, and I started making noise about it, and I inevitably started getting pushback, as you do. When you're trying to change things, no matter what it is, it can be the tiniest thing, but there's people invested in keeping things the way they are because it's comfortable, or because it's profitable, or because they like it that way. And so I remember there was a guy who wrote the Q&A for the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and every time he was interviewing a woman actress, he would imply or flat out ask her, like, who did you sleep with to get this job? He did it with Chelsea Handler. He did it with Whitney Cummings. He did it with Tippi Hedren. And finally, I'm just like, this is bizarre. And so I sent some, like, you know, sassy, snarky tweet, like, you know, traditions I could live without, watching Andrew Goldman imply that every woman in Hollywood got her success on her back. And then Andrew Goldman tweets back at Jennifer Weiner, little Freud in me thinks you're just jealous you did not have that opportunity yourself. And I'm like, holy shit, the New York Times just said no one wants to sleep with me. And I'm like, I have two kids. Someone wanted to sleep with me two times. At least. Maybe three. my God. And then, like, the ombudsman got involved, and his editor got involved, and, like, CNN did a story about it. And I'm like, now everyone is talking about why no one wants to sleep with me. Like, I could never go on JDate. FML. Anyhow, so, you know, it was like that. That was like just like one of the joyful parts. And I mean, that was kind of the worst of it. But you have to, you know, if you're a woman and you're pushing for change, you will put up with a lot of you're just jealous, you're just ugly, you're fat, no one wants to sleep with you, you're stupid, you're a fat whore. I'm like, how does that work? Like, I'm fat and I'm a whore? Like, nobody wants to sleep with me and yet I'm selling sex? Like, what? How does that work? I don't get it. And so eventually, like, I'm at, a couple weeks ago, I did a panel at Book Expo America, which is the publishing industry's, like, gigantic conference. And somebody said, you are successful. You are a bestseller. You presumably get paid nicely to do what you do. Why do you care? Why do you keep talking about this? Why do you keep pushing for it? Why are you constantly bringing it up? And I said, you know what? I am really lucky, and my stories get read and get bought. But this is a question of sort of on a global level, whose stories get told and whose get ignored? Whose voices get heard and whose get erased? Who is seen and visible and who is regarded as extraneous and unimportant? This matters. I mean, maybe it's not the biggest thing in the world, but in the grand scheme of things, like who the New York Times covers and how matters. And I'm really, really happy to tell you that this is like the first crowd I've like announced this to, but like, you know, the New York Times Book Review has a new editor. She's a woman. She's like down with the whole gender thing. In February for Valentine's Day, they covered 4 romance books. First time I think that had ever happened in the New York Times, which devotes a regular weekly column to crime fiction and to mysteries. In February, they reviewed romance, and this coming Sunday, they are reviewing 4 books by women, and one of them is All Fall Down. So. And it's a really great review, which is awesome. But I mean, I tell Lucy and Phoebe about this, and I showed them like the little picture of the review, and I said, like, this is so great and it's so exciting for me, but like, even if it wasn't mommy's name there, if it was just 4 women writing popular fiction, Lisa C is one of the other women they review, who again, like, is a great big bestseller who I don't think has ever been reviewed. I mean, these stories got seen, these voices got heard, and that matters so much. So I showed them that, and, you know, so that's one of the things I talked to them about is sort of like, if you're lucky enough to have a voice and a platform, it is incumbent upon you to use it to try to make the world a little better, a little better. Like, I'm not asking, you know, for a total do-over, but I think that you've got to stand up and speak out. And the other thing that I thought a lot about was sort of the question that I get asked a lot is, sort of, when did you know that you'd made it, right? Like, I at least once per interview, somebody's like, when did you know you'd made it? And I'm like, I made it? That happened? Like, nobody sent anything in the mail. Like, there was no certificate. But, you know, and I thought about, like, all of the moments that have sort of defined my career. I thought about selling the first book and being able to go home and tell my mother that someone was going to publish it. And they say for writers, like, the happiest day of your career is when you get to go home and say, someone is publishing my book. And I'm sure that's true for people whose books are not called Good in Bed. You know, because I just remember this, like, telling my mom, like, Simon & Schuster bought that novel that you didn't believe I was writing, and they're going to publish it. And she's, like, hugging me, and she's so proud. And then she says, what is it called? And I'm like, oh, shit. And I say, Good in Bed? She says, what? I said, Good in Bed. She says, Good and Bad? I said, no. No, it's the other thing. She says, Good in Bed? I said, mm-hmm. She says, how much research did you do? You know, but I thought about that, and then I thought about, like, finding out that the first book had made it onto the New York Times bestseller list. And I talked about learning that the second one was going to be a movie, and then actually like seeing the second one becoming a movie and sitting in an audience next to the executive and seeing like the lights go down and the Fox logo comes up, and I burst into tears and I grab her arm and I'm like, that part came out great. You know, all of those moments, having a book hit number one on the Times bestseller list, and like how wonderful all of that felt, but how the real moment I knew that I'd made it involved another writer. This woman, Sarah Pekkanen, she'd been a reporter, and she'd written her first novel sort of nights and weekends in her spare time, and she'd sold it to my editor. And in the 6 or 7 years since I'd sold Good in Bed, the publishing world had changed a lot. There were ebooks, there was independent publishing, there was lots of competition, the economy had sort of taken a nosedive. Her book was being published as a paperback original, which meant it was less expensive. It was going to find more readers, but it wasn't going to get reviewed because a lot of paperback originals just don't. And so my editor called me and she said, I don't like, you know, asking for favors, but if there's anything that you think you can do to help this woman out, I would so appreciate it, and I know she would too. And I thought, you know, Greer said, maybe you could do a giveaway. And I'm like, I can do a giveaway. And Greer said, maybe you could, like, you know, people could enter their names and, like, one winner could, like, get a signed book from you. And I said, I think I can do something more than that. And my assistant and I, my wonderful assistant, Megan, what we decided to do was a one-day giveaway. Anyone who pre-ordered Sarah's book, we would send a signed copy of one of my books. And I think we sort of guessed that it would maybe be, like, 60, 70 people, and it was, like, 462 people. ordered Sarah's book. So like on the one hand, like the two of us are running around like feral monkeys and just, you know, finding books and signing books and mailing books and shipping books. But Sarah's book made it into the top 10 on Amazon and the top 5 at Barnes & Noble. It went into a second printing before it had even been released. And people started noticing this contest and seeing this book take off and finding out why and writing about what was going on, but also writing about Sarah and the book. So it was this back alley way to sort of get people to notice the book. And I think that getting a book published is a wonderful feeling, and having a book on the bestseller list is a wonderful feeling. But for me, getting somebody else's book on the bestseller list was probably the best moment of my writing life. And that was really, really when I knew I'd made it. And so that's, you know, that's what I want to show my girls is kind of, people ask, like, what do you wish for your daughters? And I think, like, the standard answer is I want them to be happy. And I do. I very much want them to be happy. But, like, we all know the truth is that somewhere out there, there's a guy who will break one of my daughter's hearts, or there's a college that she won't get into, or there's a boss who's going to treat her horribly. That's life. Stuff goes wrong. So I wouldn't wish for my girls to be happy. I'd wish for them to be resilient. I'd wish for them to sort of know what makes them authentically happy and go for it, no matter what it is, no matter how it looks, and to know that, like, when you're feeling really, really terrible, doing something great for somebody else is, like, the best cure that I've ever found. So those are my life lessons, my little graduation speech that I'm giving to you, the class of 2014. It's been a crazy day. I woke up this morning and my boyfriend said to me, "Did you hear about the dog with diarrhea?" And I'm like, "Huh?" And Megan had gone away. Megan had gone to Italy. And I basically, like, I think I can function like an adult in the world, but really I can't, because when Megan's gone, it's like I'm emotionally crippled. And no one had told me about the diarrhea dog. So Bill is explaining to me it was a service dog on a plane that got diarrhea, and they had to, like, emergency land the plane. And I'm like, Twitter has failed me. How did I not know about this? Like, there are dogs crapping on planes and causing emergency landings, and nobody's telling me. Like, okay, so all of you guys, just please, if you're on Twitter, if you're not on Twitter, get on Twitter. If you're on Twitter, I am at Jennifer Weiner. And if there is a dog shitting in the sky, if its evacuation is causing evacuations, think of me. And let me know. And with that, I would like to take your questions. like to know something. Yes, right in front.
I would love to know about your day-to-day creative process.
Okay.
When you're working on a book, and especially how that affects the your work-life balance with your daughters.
Oh, the work-life balance. Yeah. I love the process question because it makes me think of the Inside the Actor's Studio guy who like asked that question with the exact same amount of seriousness, whether it's like Meryl Streep or J-Lo.
Right.
I'm much more J-Lo. Are you guys reading this whole thing? Can I just like digress for a brief moment? Like, she broke up with Casper Smart because allegedly he was like flirting on Instagram with like transsexual models, swimsuit models. Do we know about this? We don't know about this? Okay, thank you. I'm not a freak. So anyhow, allegedly he like was whatever you do on Instagram to message people. He was Instagramming a lady, and she said, "Do you know what kind of girl I am?" And he said, "Hey, lady, my last name's Smart." I'm like, J-Lo, how could you let that go? All right, what was the question? my process. Okay. Round about 7:15, the dog wakes up and shakes herself. And so then I wake up. And Lucy, like, won't let me in her room because she's all about her privacy. Because, as I said, she's getting boobies now. She wanted to come tonight. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. I'm like, sometimes mommy talks about you at reading. She's like, please don't. I'm like, I don't tell him your last name or anything. Just chill, okay? Get your period. So anyhow, all right. So I get up. Lucy slams the door. The little one, Phoebe, her goal in life is to look like her big sister. She says, I want to dress like little Lucy. So I have to do like the recon mission where I sneak through the bathroom and have to see what Lucy's wearing and then come back and find Phoebe the same outfit. I don't think my mother did this for me. I'm pretty sure that this was not going on in the Weiner households. But so I get Phoebe dressed, and I sort of, you know, make sure everybody brushes their teeth, and I braid hair and try to get them to eat something. Generally, they don't, not big breakfast people. And then we get in the car, and Phoebe begs me to car dance, and Lucy sits there dying, as, what is the Jason Derulo song, Wiggle, about the lady who's trying to get her butt in the jeans, right? Right? So if that comes on, like, I dance, I'm like, wiggle, wiggle. And Phoebe's like, wiggle, wiggle. And Lucy's like, I want to die. So then I drop them off. They go to the Philadelphia school, which is hippy dippy. And I've like, it's like a progressive school. They call the teachers their first names. Like, every child is a special, beautiful snowflake. And, you know, I've drunk like 80% of the Kool-Aid, but not 100. So like, I drop them off and they go to have their like enriching day. And I do... 3 or 4 days a week, I do Bikram yoga, which is the hot yoga, which is a fucking joke because, like, it is just not intended for the large-breasted among us. So, like, there's this one pose. And then, okay, so I'm going on book tour, so I downloaded Bikram himself, like, talking me through the workout. And it's like there's this one pose where it is like, put your chest on your knee. So I'm like, sit. In a chair? So I do the Bikram yoga. It's like 100 degrees. It smells like feet. There's always some man in a Speedo. Yeah, it's real bad. And then I like do that. And if I'm home, I like either will try to run really slowly or I'll do like, you know, squats and lunges and squats and burpees and squats and squats and squats. And I was doing a chat the other day and I was filling in. It was Ask Jen. And it's tried to fill in Ask Jen Seltzer, who's the tushy lady. Do you know her? She's Jen Seltzer is like a fitness, like she popularized the Belfie, which is the butt selfie. You got, like, look her up. Because I was trying to fill this in. I'm like, oh, what's this? Who's this person? I'm like, nope, that's not me. That is not me. All right, so I do my yoga. I get my exercise. I feed myself. I try to be, like, working at around 11 or noon. I work in my closet. It's a really big closet. It's like a room with it's like the Carrie Bradshaw closet, basically, but I am not Carrie. And I just, you know, even if I wanted to buy all those clothes, the designers do not serve my kind. So the closet...
Carrie Bradshaw, Park Avenue?
Yeah. The big closet that he got her. Yeah, the Mr. Big, with the shoes that. But it's so I store my kids' clothes and my books in there, and so I work in my closet and I write till like 3 or 4 or 5, and then it's nap time. And but that's kind of it. And I have a ton of help. Like that's the other thing, and I try to be really like honest about it, because so many times like you'll see a celebrity out with their kids, and you'll see like sort of in the side of the picture like a hand or some hair or a leg, and that's the nanny that they don't talk about. So I have a sitter. I have a sitter. I have an assistant. I have somebody who comes and helps clean. I have a really supportive family. Like the only way this happens is lots and lots of help. And so my kids come home in the afternoon and we have dinner together and we watch TV, we read, I supervise the bath, I get everybody to bed. And I like to be in bed by like 9:30, 10 because I love to sleep and I'm real good at it. So that's how it happens. That is how the magic goes down. Yes. Oh my God, really? My favorite restaurant in Philly. I need like a category, like BYO. Wow. Koshan. Yeah, Koshan in the book. Yeah, Koshan is really terrific, but I love Vietnam. I love Little Nana's is fantastic. Sansom Street Oyster House has the best chowder in the world. Federal Donuts is amazing. Like, it is. It's amazing.
Well,
you know.
Hello.
Oh, good. Thank you. No, but it's like my half brother, who I spend a lot of time with. He came here for a spring break, and like we went all these places. And by the last day, I'm like, so what do you want to do today? He's like, let's go to La Bus and Federal Donuts. I'm like, you are my brother. We are related. So, but God, there's so much good food here, and I it makes me very happy. It really does. I love living in Philadelphia. Someone over here have a question? I don't want to neglect the flanks. Yes.
I just wanted to share with you my experience of talking to my girls about.
Oh, please help me. Help me.
I can't say that it's going to be helpful. I have 3 daughters.
Okay.
And myself and a lot of other women got forced into this back in the 70s. We lived in the northeast section of the city. And there were probably 60 row homes on each side of the street. And stay-free maxi pads had just been invented.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And they were coming around hanging them on doorknobs. Yes.
Yeah.
This is the God's honest truth.
So that was what happened?
This is.
Wow.
I'm sitting at the sewing machine, which was up in my bedroom. And the kids come in and they say, Mom, what are these things? They're uh-huh. giving them out for free. I'm like, okay, let me see. You know, I'm like looking at them. I said, oh, God. So I call up my next door neighbor. She said the same thing. Her uh-huh. kids are there, boys and girls in her house. And so I went back to the sewing machine. My kids are sitting on my bed behind me. And so I'm not looking at them. And I'm giving them the talk about the birds and the bees. And it was wonderful because I didn't have to see their faces, like you said, about your daughters going, you know, in
so
horror. About
I have to wait for someone to leave a maxi pad on my door, though?
I'm just relating to you how it came
okay,
about by
right.
house.
No, that's awesome. I hope it happens. Like
I was forced into it, you know.
Yeah.
And then the moms had a big talk amongst themselves, mm-hmm. you know, about how they went about it. And everybody had a different story, but, you know, asked my kids. Yeah, my mom didn't even look at me when she talked about how it happened.
But you know what? Like, you talked to them. Like, you didn't punt. You didn't, go ask your science teacher. So.
No.
No, you, I have, I think you did fine.
Would a Sunday evening find you watching Downton Abbey or The Real Housewives of Atlanta? And what do you watch on TV?
Oh, boy. I don't have a Sunday show. I don't. You know, I think I tried Penny Dreadful once, but it was like, I like, what is it?
Game of Thrones.
You know what? I read the books, and I can't, I don't know. It's like The Good Wife. No, I no. You know what? Because I was writing a book about. There were similar things, and so I couldn't watch it. I was writing Goodnight Nobody, and it sort of had like similar themes to that. And I Fly Away Home, like disgraced politician and wife trying to make her way. I couldn't watch it, so I don't have a Sunday show. It's weird. It's like I have The Bachelor, and yeah, of course I have The Bachelor, but I don't know. It's my mom watches The Housewives, and a couple of them like follow me on Twitter, which is really funny and strange. Like Bethany, who like her whole thing is skinny girl, and I'm like, why are you following me? Like I feel a little strange about this. Like I love her, but I don't have a Sunday show. I got to work on. What would you recommend? Homeland, The Good Wife. Master, okay. Okay. All right, I gotta go. I'm gonna talk to TiVo. We're gonna get this all worked out.
Why did you decide to tweet The Bachelor?
Oh,
and are you getting any cut of the revenue? For the
right? Okay, why did I decide to tweet The Bachelor? Like many things in my life, it was an accident. I was not watching religiously, but I flipped to the end of Jason Mesnick's season. Now, you will remember Jason Mesnick as the bachelor who wept like a six-year-old girl, okay? He was trying to decide between Molly Mulaney and Melissa Rycroft, and he proposed to one of them and then dumped her on the After the Rose special and proposed to the other girl. So, but anyhow, leading up to this, I just like flip, and there he is standing on the balcony sobbing as if his heart would break. And so I'm on Facebook, and I send this like status update. Jason Mesnick is a real tool. And I get 900 likes. And I'm like, I am on to something with this. And so like the next season, I just started like Twitter and that show seemed like two things that were made for each other. In terms of like, the show is so bad it's good. You can't like not watch it and want to say something. And Twitter, it's like being in a room full of people all yelling at the television set. So it's like home, you know? It's so... But it was accidental, and no, I don't get anything from anyone, which, like, I feel like I really should, because I feel like I've managed to, like, enliven some really bad seasons, you know? Like Andy is just not doing it for me. I don't know why. Like, I think she's perfectly smart, and probably we'd be, like, get along in real life, but, like, I just don't know. I don't know what it is. Like, these guys, it's this, like, weird crop of crap. It's very strange. Anybody else? Yes. In Her Shoes is her favorite movie ever.
is any part of that at all related to your personal life?
Is any part of that related to my... I didn't have to say that again because you had the microphone. Yeah, I mean, I have a sister and she's 15 months younger than I am and she's the hot one. She has to pay me every time I say that in public. But, you know, I was... None of the specifics exactly except... My sister learns differently, which we used to call learning disabilities, but now we don't. Now it's learns differently. But she does and struggled a lot with that in the 70s and 80s before we were as aware and when it was much more likely for someone to just think you're stupid. You know, not that you learn differently, but that you're dumb. I wanted to talk about the dynamic of sisters. I wanted to talk about how you can like be two people that come from the exact same place and grow up in the exact same circumstances and be so different. And I wanted to talk about sort of the internal life of the prom queen. You know, the girl who is beautiful and does real well in high school, but, you know, sort of the girl who peaks at 18 maybe, and like, where does that leave you? So that, I mean, like in many of my books, like it's not ever directly personal. It's more of like the raw material of my own life sort of transformed into fiction, sort of worked and shaped and edited and molded and changed. So that was what happened with In Her Shoes. But thank you. I'm glad. I love the movie too. I thought they did a great job with it. Yes. How long does it take? About 9 months, which is weird. Yeah, it's like, you know, 9 months, either like draft of book or baby is coming out. That's how long it takes. And it's sort of, you know, 9 months and then like extensive revisions. Like my agent will read a copy and then I'll rewrite. My editor will read a copy, I'll rewrite. They'll both read the third copy and they'll both give me notes and then I'll rewrite that. So there's a lot of work that goes into it. I mean, the good news is I'm a former newspaper reporter, so it doesn't feel like burdensome to me to sort of do that kind of work. Like I actually really welcome, I like writing a lot, but I like the rewriting even better because it's like you've sort of got the house built and now you get to pick out the wallpaper and the carpet and the furniture and stuff. That's the fun part for me. So year from start to finish, but 9 months for the draft. Should we do like two more questions and then like we'll eat cannoli and I'll sign your books? Yes. They do come out on Audible, and Tracy Chimou did the audiobook for this one. She's on Orange is the New Black, which I love. Like that's my Sunday thing, I think. Oh my God. Yes. Tracy plays Piper's brother's girlfriend. The like crazy, like underwater. Yeah, she's nuts. But I haven't actually heard it yet, but everybody says it's remarkable. So I'm really excited to hear it. I did narrate one of my books. I did Little Earthquakes. I was super excited. And then Publishers Weekly reviewed it. And it were like, you know, well, Weiner has a very pleasant voice. It's like, it's really, she's not very good. And I'm like, but they all sounded different in my head. Publishers Weekly. So anyhow, I don't think I'll do that again. It was fun. It was a good time. I got to like go in the recording studio and have like the headphones on. It was kind of cool. But all right, last question. Yes, in front there.
With like the 24-hour news cycle and all this content curation, are there any blogs that you follow, or do you find it just a lot of chatter that weighs you down?
I follow Twitter. And I sort of like follow like a good list of people on Twitter. So like, I don't know how the diarrhea dog like fell through the cracks the way it did. I'm a little angry about it still. But, you know, I read Jezebel. I read The Hairpin. I read, what do I read? People.com for all. Yeah, I'm sorry, but I do. Like somebody needs to keep up with who wore it best and all that good stuff. Well, who wore it best is us, which is... When my daughters were babies, like my friends and I used to get together and like put them in the same onesies and play who wore it best. So, you know, and it would be like a white Old Navy onesie. So like nobody wore it best, but like, or it'd be like a diaper. You know, who wore it best? But yeah, it's generally like feminism, gossip, realitysteve.com. Like that's kind of it. And the New York Times, you know, I get my news, CNN, Philly.com, you know, see which part of 95 they've closed because of a... I can't get fucking anywhere, you guys. Like, my driver got lost coming back from Baltimore last night because, like, the port of Wilmington, they're doing this big detour around. So I fell asleep in the car. This is really scary. I fall asleep in the car. I wake up. We're driving through some, like, creepy residential neighborhood, and I'm like, where are we? And the driver didn't answer for a minute. And I'm like, oh God, this is it. I'm being kidnapped and I'm gonna be sold into white slavery. Or they're taking my kidneys. I don't know which it is, and I don't know which is worse. You know, and then he's just like, I got lost on the detour. I'm like, oh thank God. And I'm like, well, that's bad. Wait a minute, shouldn't you? And then today, like coming back from Princeton, they were Columbus Boulevard was like both ways on one half of it because I guess there was a really bad crash this morning there. Like wow, it's like I want to ride my bike places now. It's like I'm really worried. Someone else here had a question too. Yes. Yeah, I mean, you know, some of it was just sort of addiction in general and reading about like women and about like what's really going on. I mean, like People Magazine did a huge story and then the New York Times did a huge story. And I think that like because I wanted to write about a woman who was sort of like a functioning addict, like a high bottom addict. I didn't want it to be heroin and I didn't want it to be alcohol because I think alcohol has been done a lot and heroin didn't seem likely. So it was sort of process of elimination. Yeah. So yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of favorite books that I hold close to me and go back to a lot. Susan Isaacs wrote a couple of my favorites. She wrote Shining Through and Almost Paradise. And I love her books because they have like funny, smart, flawed Jewish protagonists who like get the guy and get the happy ending like without ever looking like Miss America. So I like her books a lot. And I went back to Little Women because Phoebe bought, or someone bought for her like a kid's version of that. And it's great. I mean, like, once you take out all the parts about them playing Pilgrim's Progress and stuff, it's like, it's really a good read. So, okay, I think I'm going to end this. I'm going to go upstairs and sign books. So get some cannoli, take your time. Thank you all for coming. This is fantastic.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.